Hi there. Welcome to episode 4 of Published by Greenleaf Book Group. My name is Tanya Hall. Today I will be doing part 2 of my conversation with Sam Alexander about author branding.
Welcome to Published, a podcast by Greenleaf Book Group, where we'll discuss the ins and outs of the publishing industry, from writing a book and finding the right publisher to gearing up for a book launch. And now, here's your host, Greenleaf Book Group CEO, Tanya Hall.
Okay, in our last episode, we went through some author branding questions like, what is an author brand? Why is it important? And today, in this episode, we'll be doing a deeper dive into the individual components of that author brand, like website, social media channels, newsletter, all the moving parts that help to make the more powerful whole. So Sam Alexander was nice enough to do this two-part series with us. He's our brand strategist here at Greenleaf Book Group. And welcome back, Sam.
Thanks, Tanya.
Okay, so let's jump right into website, because we have a lot to cover in terms of the components of the author platform, and I think this is obviously one of huge importance. So first and foremost, very, very typical, popular question, does every author need a website?
I would say that the short answer is no. Simply because when you talk about an author brand or a platform, it's important to have sort of the center of that brand's universe. I think the ideal state, certainly for somebody who's serious about building their brand as an author, a website is probably table stakes. But if you are just starting out and the idea of creating a website is a little bit overwhelming. Maybe you've built up a bit of a following on Facebook or on, you know, Instagram if you're an artist, or have visual content that's compelling. By all means, there's no thing that says you have to build an audience around a website. Look at all the people who are known as YouTubers who have built incredibly powerful brands based on that platform. There are a lot of benefits, of course, though, to having a website, and I'm sure we'll touch on some of them in a moment.
Well, actually, let's touch on them now since you rolled right into it. I think there may be some pros and cons to building your platform on your own website versus a third-party platform.
Yeah, the cons are a much shorter list than the pros. I'll speak to them first. The only real downside is that it's a certain amount of responsibility and accountability that you assume when you create your own website. So it's something that you have to build from scratch, which can feel a little bit overwhelming or intimidating. And it's a bit of a cost. It's not a crazy cost by any means, certainly at this day and age. But those are really the only two downsides to creating your website. On the other side of the coin, there are incredibly powerful benefits to having your own website as the hub of your content and your message. The first is really that it's completely under your control. That's one of the things we talk about that is maybe a little bit outside of people's view, is that when you're talking about social media in particular, there are terms and conditions, terms of service that you agree to whenever you're operating on that platform, whether you're doing so as a creator or just a consumer of content. And those rules are subject to change at any given time. And 100% for certainly the companies that have already gone public or are part of public companies, that they ultimately are driving at profit. And the ones that are newer, that haven't yet hit that stage, I mean, Snapchat a few months ago would have been in that category, are driving towards that finish line or starting point, I guess, depending on how you look at it. So there are other objectives that those platforms have that are beside you sharing your content with your audience. And your website would be a place that can be completely dedicated to your message. You, again, have complete control over what appears on it. You don't have to stick within 140 characters. You don't have to, be beholden to any sort of advertising scheme or, organic reach. We talk about all the time, and Facebook is certainly a huge challenge on that platform. But I would say that, if you're serious about building your brand as an author, a website is a great place to help you expand that message and let it live and be more discoverable to an audience.
Okay, that's great. So a little bit of a brass tacks question then. For an author who's looking at going out and starting their own website and probably first step buying a URL, do they brand around their name or the book title?
That's definitely a personal decision, and authors kind of do it both ways. I would say that if you are a nonfiction author and you are looking to share your ideas, that it's probably best to start and build on your name as opposed to the name of a book. Your name gives you credit for everything that you do, past, present, and future. And you might end up wanting to reframe from the name of your first book. So it's probably best, if the author is comfortable with it, to build on a website based on their name.
Agreed. So once you have the URL figured out, and of course you can buy multiple URLs and redirect as well, what are the elements that really set apart a good author website or an effective author website?
This could look any number of different ways. It depends quite a bit on the person and on the content and on their audience, what their audience is interested in. But I would say the hallmarks of a great author website are pretty simply and clearly explaining who you are and who you're for, articulating that message and making it useful to your audience in whatever form that takes. You know, there are some best practices. I mean, if you're able to integrate video, I think that's a little bit more engaging. If you make it easy to navigate, certain web basics obviously would be considered in an excellent author website as well. But you basically want to make it as easy as possible for your audience to find you and to consume your content and be helped by it. And then, share that message with other people who might be, also in that whatever need state you might be addressing. And doing it in a way that, is mobile friendly. So you certainly don't want to build something that is going to look weird on people's phones. Mobile is a huge thing that's been going on for years and years, but it is only accelerating from this point. Mm-hmm. So that's also, one important thing that we always look at a new website for evaluating.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And should authors be worried about setting up a shopping cart and selling books on their website?
That's very much an author by author decision. If you have the capability to sell directly and you have an audience that is going to trust you and is willing to buy directly from you, there's no downside to it from my perspective. With that said, I think there are some hurdles to get over if you're selling directly on your website. And probably the biggest one is consumer trust. They're giving you directly their credit card information versus going through an established retailer like Amazon BardsandNoble.com, where they know they probably already have a relationship with that retailer at some level, and they probably have an established level of trust with sharing their sensitive information.
Yes, and probably also worth noting that not all authors will be able to sell their books directly on their websites. It really depends on what rights you've held on to with your deal with your publisher. So check that before you make any decisions. Don't blame Sam. So if you are building from scratch, what are the first steps? Do you get a developer? Do you just use a WordPress platform? How do you advise folks to get started?
That's a great question, and there's no single right answer, I don't think. The first thing I think if you're building a website is to think about those questions that I sort of asked or answered earlier on is what is your message? How are you looking to present yourself? There are a lot of options where you can sort of build your own website, things like Squarespace or Wix. And those are certainly, if you don't have the resources or the time to build on something like WordPress, certainly can do the job. But they're in some ways similar to what we were talking about with Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn, where you're not necessarily the ultimate owner and controller of that content. Somebody like a Squarespace could change their terms, and that could have a pretty important effect on what you're able to do on your website. So I would say the first step is to sort of just search for people who help build websites. And I would say there's so much information out there where you can educate yourself on the process. That doesn't mean that you have to become an expert, but I think just learning the kind of overall process and understanding what that looks like is probably a great step in finding what the right step is for you where you stand today.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. And it just occurred to me that maybe you'd like to share your Twitter handle with folks if they have questions about specifics on a website, if you're open to it. If not, you can tell me to shut up and we'll edit it out.
No problem. I am happy to share. I am on Twitter at @GBG_Sam. Nice and easy. And if you know Greenleaf's branding, I am pretty clearly identified as a Greenleaf employee.
A Greenleafer.
A Greenleafer.
Okay, good. GBG_Sam. Very good. So moving on to, since we're talking about Twitter, moving on to social media. So obviously, as we've mentioned, lots of platforms to choose from with new ones springing up all the time. So which platform would you recommend an author spend most of their time on?
This one is largely dependent on the author, him or herself, and the content, because the things that go into that, making that decision are, to me, especially somebody, a lot of our authors are relatively new to the social media game. So they might feel a little bit overwhelmed or intimidated. So I would say certainly start with where you're comfortable and just get more comfortable there and then look to sort of add as appropriate. But the other big thing is where is your audience, right? If you are targeting a professional audience, you're probably not going to be looking on Snapchat. That's not to say that people who are targeting a business audience can't succeed greatly on Snapchat. Somebody like Mark Suster has built a great platform and uses Snapchat super effectively when talking to entrepreneurs and venture capitalists. He's a great example of there's no real rhyme or reason necessarily or rules that you have to follow. But I think looking at where your audience is and where the content is going to be most appropriate, I wouldn't advise, it's not maybe the best idea to go into something like Instagram or Pinterest if your content doesn't have some form of visual appeal. It could be text-based, which you can build some visual appeal into through some design work, but the content needs to be appropriate for the channel and for the audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's certainly where you will get the most impact out of it, which is the whole point of doing this stuff to begin with. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in terms of managing the time, obviously you can spend a little bit of time doing this, you can spend a lot of time doing this, and there have been some healthy conversations for sure in social media circles about planning posts in advance, maybe some of the pros and cons around that. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Anytime you can be strategic about how you're communicating, I think that's a great idea. That doesn't mean that you should be, so I guess the short answer to should you plan out content, the answer for me is absolutely yes. At the same time, should you be beholden to those plans? Absolutely not. Your platform is intended to be a reflection or an amplification of who you are. So you shouldn't be somebody who you're not on any social media platform. And if you've planned on, you know, discussing business with somebody and then, you know, the circumstances around that meeting with that person change, you know, you're not going to just stick to exactly what you were planning on talking about. And I think that general rule probably applies to social media as well. You know, there are certainly occasions where it's inappropriate to talk about certain things. There might be something going on in the world that takes precedence and mm-hmm. demands a change in tone or, you know, a change in your plans. But, you know, with that said, I think it's about planning and being flexible and adapting to whatever circumstances there are. And that also gives you the opportunity to pursue other opportunities that you hadn't foreseen. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's a big news item that comes out today that you were planning on talking about in 2 months, forget about that. Talk about it right now. You know, strike while the iron's hot. You're bound to get more engagement, more reach when you're talking about relevant content. So, you know, like I said, I think it boils down to being structured and tactical about it, but also being flexible.
Mm-hmm. Good. Good advice. Okay. So ready to play a game?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so we'll talk about some of the major social media platforms. You give me one or two takeaways of how to behave on each of these platforms. Okay?
Yes.
Okay, here we go. Twitter.
I am a fairly heavy Twitter user myself, and it's taken me a few years to get to where I am right now. I'm not a prolific tweeter, but I consume a lot of information, and so my top advice is to listen before you talk. The rules on Twitter and the way that you talk, the way you engage, are different than virtually anywhere else in the world. That 140 character limit changes things. So definitely get familiar with Twitter and optimize how you communicate there. So that's one. And I would say this is something I'm extremely guilty of and probably why I'm a less prolific tweeter than I could be, is don't stress out about it too much. I've seen the stat, I think, on Moz that the average tweet has a lifespan of 18 minutes. Twitter is a constantly evolving stream and, you know, it will live on forever. So if you ever find yourself in hot water, people might go back in your timeline. But by and large, for the most part, if you're thinking about tweeting it and you can't think of a good reason why not to, go for it.
Yeah.
Don't put too much pressure on those 140 characters.
Yeah. Worst case, you can delete it and pray that nobody did a screenshot.
Very true. Very true.
Famous people problems.
Yeah.
Okay. Next one, Facebook.
This one's tough because it's become such a pay-to-play environment. Right now, I would echo what a lot of the sort of experts are saying is that if you are at all comfortable with video and being informal, Facebook Live is an enormous opportunity. Facebook is looking to, as I understand it at least, looking to encourage that user behavior. They've been running advertisements for, you know, on TV, which is not cheap, for Facebook Live. If you can leverage video on this platform, that's definitely gonna give you the best chance to break through and gain some organic reach and build a followership. And, you know, it's about getting engagement. All of social media really is, but particularly on Facebook, I think if you're able to start conversations and get people sharing and engaging with what you've posted, that's going to be give your best chance for success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. All right, LinkedIn.
LinkedIn is about knowing your environment as much as anything else. It's very much about professional communication, so tone should be, you know, appropriate for that. It's also where you're expected to network. Certainly on Twitter is a great one-to-one opportunity for communicating with people, but LinkedIn, you know, you can be a little more business focused on that platform. You can also be a little bit lengthier. You can post more in-depth and longer thought pieces. And engaging with other people's content also, you know, engenders you to them and to gives you sort of other ways in which to express your perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some goodwill can be built there.
Absolutely.
How about Instagram?
Instagram If your content is really visually focused, this is a little bit of a different situation because you're able to highlight what the most important thing is for you. But for people who are not sort of building on a visual brand, Instagram is a place to be yourself. You know, people have varying degrees of comfort with that, and that's totally fine. There's no thing that says that you have to be on Instagram in the first place, and there's nothing that says you have to be, you know, sharing your personal life. But I think Instagram is a almost a lifestyle avenue for a lot of authors, and that's an opportunity that's there if you want to take it.
Mm-hmm. And what about Pinterest?
Pinterest is about shareability, and similar to Instagram, you definitely have to have some visual appeal to it. You know, I think Pinterest is such a transactional, or it offers maybe the best opportunity to be transactional. Mm-hmm. So it's a place where you definitely want to focus on helping your audience and being shareable. But also, you know, I don't think it's a bad thing to link back to, you know, your site and try to get people in there. If you're selling product, then by all means, you know, link to a buy page. Mm-hmm. So Pinterest is an interesting one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's a lot on the various social media platforms. And then there's one other element, at least, of platform that we spend a lot of time at Greenleaf talking to our authors about. And I think sometimes they're surprised that is newsletters. And I think sometimes they feel like that's this old archaic thing that people don't do anymore. But really they're, and I'm about to put words in your mouth and I will stop, but they're of critical importance. So can you talk to us a little bit about the benefit of a newsletter and the role that it plays in an author's platform?
Yeah, newsletters have always been, as you said, a very, very important, and you could even argue that they're the most important piece of a platform. And the biggest reason for that is that it is a direct connection to where virtually every consumer will spend a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. Every day, every week, and in perpetuity. Like, I think I've read somewhere that you know, people change their profiles, people move on to new social media platforms. You know, if you've got an old MySpace page, you probably haven't been there in a while. But you don't really change your email address very often. And if you do, I mean, that's a big change, right? Yeah. It's a part of who you are in today's world. And so having a connection to that inbox, you know, of course, there are always filters, there are ad blockers, there are lots of barriers to you communicating with people who have expressed interest. But the newsletter, to my mind, kind of gives you the most direct route to talk to somebody. And if you're generating new content on a regular basis, but for whatever reason, if you've built on Facebook and your organic reach is not what you wish it would be, and somebody liked your page, they still might not have seen anything from you if they hadn't had a reason to go to your website. And that newsletter is a way to sort of remind them why they were interested in the first place. And, you know, you mentioned people thinking they might be archaic. There are, you know, lots of new sort of ways in which to use a newsletter. Our manager of the brand and marketing team is using something called Tiny Letter that is essentially just a stripped down, very basic newsletter format. She's got an audience that she's built out, you know, on her own personal time, and she's, you know, no longer blogging, but she's using Tiny Letter to communicate with that audience. Mm-hmm. So a newsletter could sound like this thing that is no longer relevant in today's media landscape, but it doesn't have to be. It can be as involved and complicated, as rich of an experience as you would like to make it, or as simple as sort of reminding people why they came to you in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Good. So in this episode, of course, we're trying to give the tools to help people start building a platform. So for a newsletter, what are the kind of go-to tools that you would, or platforms that you would explore as you're making a decision on how to implement your own?
Well, if you are building a newsletter list or a list period, and using a newsletter to help generate that. I think you'll probably want to base it on your website. So, you know, you asked earlier what one of the hallmarks of, what are the hallmarks of a good author website? One of them to me is, if they're serious about building that audience, is some easy sort of value for value exchange that is a call to action on their website, ideally above the fold, that's saying, here's this extra piece of content that you can have. And in exchange, I'm asking for, you know, this piece of information from you that lets me communicate with you. So I think the sign up mechanism, whatever it is, probably ideally on your website, is crucially important. You know, there's a lot of depth to optimizing newsletters. I think one of the best practices to send a welcome to somebody when they've signed up, confirming that they have in fact signed up, and reminding them if they ever search in their email inbox, you know, why am I getting this? They've forgotten.
Because you asked,
exactly. So that's certainly a good idea. And then, you know, when you get into what to actually include in a newsletter, there are no set rules. You know, there are kind of basic templated type of things. You could use it as a way to resurface content that you've posted in the past month or quarter or week or whatever. Ideally, you're sort of providing something, some bit of your content that is not accessible in any other way. That's really the reason why, for an author, somebody's going to have that reason to sign up, because they're getting a little bit of bonus content.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so they're signing up on the website, but on the back end, of course, the author is using a newsletter management platform, typically. Is there one that you would most commonly recommend?
We typically recommend MailChimp as an email marketing service. Certainly not the only one. And if you're a business person who maybe is running their own business and you've got, you know, Constant Contact or something like that, you know, that's a fantastic platform as well. But if you're looking for the sort of, I think we typically recommend MailChimp because it offers a free option to sort of get started up. It's very flexible and pretty intuitive to use. It also links into a lot of different platforms, so you can share on social media, and it just kind of makes it pretty easy. So we typically recommend MailChimp, but by no means is that, you know, the only option.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And finally, what about frequency? I think a lot of people worry that newsletter goes straight into someone's trash because we all get bombarded with this stuff. So any best practices around how often to send out a newsletter?
It really depends on how much content you've got and want to share. I follow a former coworker and a just generally smart guy named Ferris Jakob, who has a newsletter that just switched from weekly to biweekly called Strands of Genius. And I think I get new content to share on social media every single, well, twice a week now. But the general gist of it, I think, is, you know, when do you have newsworthy content to share? One of my authors, who's a fiction author, S. Alexander O'Keefe, we've got his newsletter set up to go out quarterly, because he's writing fiction novels that there's a very long lead time between when the next book is coming out. And we essentially use it as an avenue to update his fans on progress on that book, on what's kind of going on in his author life. If you've got a structured message, if you've got, you know, a process that you wrote a book about, you know, you could send that once a week. You could send it once a month. It really boils down to, I think, how you're adding value to your audience. You'd never want to send one just because it's time to send one. Yeah. You definitely want to have a purpose behind it. And if you've got a lot of sort of details to share, then more frequent might make more sense.
Mm-hmm. Good. All right. Excellent advice. And I think that does it for us in this episode. We covered so much ground. So thank you, Sam. Really appreciate your input here. Notes from today's show will be available at greenleafbookgroup.com/episode4. 4. greenleafbookgroup.com/episode4. We hope that you learned a lot from this two-part series, and next up we'll be discussing proof of concept and figuring out where your book fits in among the competition. So subscribe on iTunes to get new episodes right away.
Thanks for listening to Published. To learn more, please visit greenleafbookgroup.com. And remember to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes.